I'm Jim Eldringham. This is My Crummy Little Podcast. If you're listening in America, you may not be aware that there's an election happening up in Canada, but not to worry. This week's guest is one of Canada's best and brightest political and public affairs operatives, Robin Spear. He served in senior campaign roles both in the provinces and in Canada's capital, which, as any American schoolchild can tell you, is Toronto. He's worked for current Prime Minister Stephen Harper, current Agricultural Minister Jerry Ritz, and in the provincial government of Saskatchewan. Robin Spear, thanks for joining this crummy little podcast.
Thanks for having me, Jim, and go Blue Jays.
See, that's I knew if I made that Toronto joke, you were going to start needling me about the Blue Jays-Yankees race.
We're very excited. It's the Jays right now have the identical record they did back in 92 and 93 at this point in the season. I'm from Western Canada, and we're not huge fans of Toronto, as they think they're the center of the universe, at least in Canada. But from coast to coast to coast, everybody is on the bandwagon. 22 years later, the World Series is coming north.
No, that is actually kind of a fun race, and one that I don't think anybody thought was going to happen, maybe with those two teams, because as stacked as Toronto's been the last few years, and as much money as the Yankees spend every year, Yankees haven't been all that great. Toronto hasn't performed to expectations, but now everybody else who was a darling of the division has just dropped off, and it's Yankees and Toronto, which is fun. It definitely does have an early 90s vibe to it.
It really does. No, and I know that there's four or five Canadian players on the Jays this year, at least in the system. Even from my small hometown in Saskatchewan, is Andrew Albers. He's pitching in AAA Buffalo right now, but Canadians from four or five provinces, actually, in the Jays system, they have played games this season, so it's exciting. Certainly those deals a month ago at the deadline have catapulted them there. And I know, our, like you say, from the outset, our election campaign is underway, but it's been underway for a month now, and I think half the Canadians don't even know what's going on, but everybody's cheering on the Jays. So we've got a three-way political race for the first time ever. It's very tight and divided, not unlike we've seen in the U.S. in the last 15, 20 years, but even more so with a three-way split. But everybody's behind the Jays, so that's exciting in that sense. But election season and baseball season.
So coming up October 19th, you mentioned that there's this tight three-way race. You've got the Conservatives, which you've done a lot of work for, and we've known each other, 12 or 13 years, and probably as long as I've known you, you've been right at the heart of the Conservative Party. You've got the New Democratic Party, or NDP, and you've got the Liberals, and everybody running neck and neck on at least the last polls I've seen. What are the storylines of this election? What is this election about?
Well, you're right, Jim, and I mean that's one of the storylines right now is this tight race. We've never seen this before in Canada. It's always been a race between the Liberals and the Conservatives. Notwithstanding a few elections where parties have factioned and then reformed, but it's always been a version of the Conservative Party and the Liberal Party. We had several elections in the last decade here. The Liberals were brought down to minority government status back in 2004. And then in 2005-06, that's when Stephen Harper won his own minority government. And so because minority governments are inherently unstable, there was subsequent elections in 2008 where his minority was increased, and then in May 2011 where Stephen Harper won a majority government. And so we've had 4.5 years of a majority government, strong, stable government to this point. And that's certainly the narrative that they're moving forward with, that the Conservatives are best placed to govern in times of global economic instability and volatility in other affairs globally, especially as we've seen even in the last few days here, events in the Middle East and in China. And so that's certainly what they're running on, their record. What did happen in 2011 was the New Democratic Party, as you mentioned, they had a strong campaign, especially in the province of Quebec, where the former separatist movement in Quebec, the Bloc Québécois, all but collapsed. Just won a couple of seats, down from 57 seats in the House of Commons. And so they've actually been building off of that. Their leader, he unfortunately passed away during the parliament. The new leader, Thomas Mulcair, he was a Quebec politician at the provincial level with the provincial Liberals, became the NDP leader just over 3 years ago. And so he's maintained that momentum for them, and they're essentially tied in the polls with Harper's Conservatives and then Justin Trudeau, the new leader of the Liberal Party, son of Pierre Trudeau, which a lot of Americans remember his time as Canadian Prime Minister for a variety of reasons.
I was looking at some of the latest polling, and as you mentioned, all neck and neck. The projections that I've seen show a NDP gaining a plurality, not a majority, and see Conservatives dipping down to somewhere around like the 115 to 120 seat level, while the NDP is closer to 125 to 130. If that plays out, what does that mean going? Does that mean a change, obviously, in the prime minister, or is it a little more complex than that?
Well, it's a little bit more complex. You're certainly right, though. That is sort of what we're hearing right now. Those seat counts, of course, are based more on the overall national numbers than a riding by riding analysis. The parties are all polling around 30-31%, something like that. The Bloc is trying to make a resurgence in Quebec, but there'll be a minor party there. We do also have the Green Party in Canada. They typically poll 4 or 5%, something like that. They do have one seat in British Columbia, in the Victoria area. And so that incumbent, the leader there, is running again as well. There's a lot at play there. Certainly the NDP and the Liberals are fighting for the center-left and the hard-left. And so as they're trying to out-left one another, obviously, Harper and the Conservatives are making the case that they've led the Canadian economy through the turbulent times of the downturn in 2007, 2008, 2009. Canada had the strongest economic growth record, actually, in the G7. Stability, not a lot of job losses. In fact, a significant job creation over that time. And they've beefed up Canada's role in the world with on the defense front, and certainly being involved in the fight with ISIS in the Middle East with our NATO allies, including the U.S. So the Conservatives are, they're running on their record. The others are fighting for that share of the vote. And it'll break down in different ways. If the NDP can hold on to a lot of that would-be Liberal support in the province of Quebec, for example, they'll maintain some of those seats. Whereas, for example, in Toronto, the Liberals might bleed them on the left, and they may pick up some seats. So, we're a long ways out, but you're right, it's a three-way race now, and it's not inconceivable that all parties could very well end up with 110 seats or so, give or take. And then what does that mean? We'd be in a sort of bizarre three-way Mexican standoff in an odd minority parliament. And maybe unprecedented as well, as far as what that means for who the Canadian Prime Minister is. If there's a coalition on the left, that's become a big issue in this debate. If the NDP or the Liberals happen to win the most seats, a plurality but not a majority, will they just join together and create a majority left-wing coalition government? So certainly lots to play out at this point. And I should point out as well, it's a 78-day campaign in Canada, which for you guys is a few days in between some primaries, a year before a general election, and you're campaigning the entire time. And for us, it's 78 days. That's the longest campaign since 1872, which was the second election in Canada. In fact, we've had two prime ministers that barely even served as long as this RIP period. So it's a really interesting dynamic in that front that we've not seen a campaign this long. The first month was August, where typically, I don't think a lot of folks would be paying a lot of attention. I think they are now back to school, back to work. And I think the real campaign is now underway, and we'll see where those numbers shake out in the coming weeks.
Yeah, we've got 14 months to go before our presidential election. That's all we're talking about. You guys have 78 days. So you're very efficient. You get it done.
We get it done. And this is long. You know, I said we had minority governments, and we had an election in 08 and 11. And this campaign is longer than those two combined. It's quite something. And another analogy, I guess, would be, you know, at the debate table, we have these three main leaders, the prime minister and the two opposition leaders, as well as the Green Party leader and the Bloc Party leader. And so the debate is now also part of the narrative. Should the Bloc leader be at some of these debates? Should the Green Party leader be at some of these debates? And, of course, a few weeks ago, I had to sit around for 4 or 5 hours to watch your GOP debate with 10 folks on stage, and then I realized that was just the B debate, and then then 10 more on the A team debate. So, it's interesting. Five leaders, three real leaders, and a long campaign for Canada.
Well, see, at least we had, you know, Donald Trump sucking up entertainment on the debate, so that we could provide that. Now, I mean, you guys could always just drop what's his name, Wyatt Scott, into those.
Yeah, the man who flies on the Canada Goose and slays aliens.
That's the only thing, by the way, anybody in America knows about the Canadian election. The ones that are even paying attention we know that we've got a guy up there who was riding on a goose and fighting dragons in a political ad.
Yeah, and there I go. I'm not even mentioning the independent candidates. That's right.
and I think there's actually a movement to draft him for like a congressional district in Minnesota or something like that. Someone's looking to trade for him.
Easy. Well, he could fly over on a goose. They're making their way south right now. So there you go.
See, if he could be an MP to be named later in the David Price deal or something like that.
Yeah, exactly.
We were talking a little bit about polling and how it's a, you know, a three-way race and how that's showing everything tightening up considerably. The last few cycles down here, we've had a lot of trouble with public polling, less so with internal campaign polling, but national public polls that are done by news organizations have had a real difficult time predicting election outcomes. Are you having the same problem with that up there? Are you having the same challenges?
We are, a big time. You know, in fact, I've seen a little bit about what you've mentioned down there. In fact, in the last couple of years, there was recently the last provincial election in British Columbia, where Premier Christy Clark of the BC Liberal Party, it's sort of a coalition of anyone but the NDP. So the Liberals are the Liberals, but they're also the Conservatives and sort of anyone center right. You know, they were coming out of the recession, obviously, and running on their record, and the polling numbers for the opposition NDP party in BC to win were just off the charts. It was a no-brainer that they were going to win a majority government as of that morning of election day, and we're talking, you know, more than a point or two. We're talking double-digit spreads, and lo and behold, I know the internal pollster, and he was making noise the last week that these public polls were way off. And sure enough, on election day, the BC Liberals were reelected with a majority government in their provincial legislature. A similar thing happened a couple of years ago where I am here in Alberta. Again, a double-digit spread right until election day. So, you know, there was an election here in Alberta recently where the numbers were so odd that no one believed them. Because of these precedents of the last couple of cycles in Western Canada. And they, you know, they tweaked their methodologies. They obviously everybody had to go back and sort of lick their wounds in the polling industry and relook at methodologies and understand what was happening. And so even with these numbers in this last Alberta election being what they were, showing an opposition party having an unprecedented majority, overwhelming majority, defeating a long-term government here, the polling companies were trying to throw out caveats so that they wouldn't be embarrassed by the results again. But I think they had done their homework, and the results, those numbers out. And so I think you can see a lot of lessons learned in this federal campaign this time, based on what you say, you know, with the reality of you know, the mobility of folks today and mobile phones and all sorts of different things like that and methodologies for that matter. So it's improving, but it has sort of been disastrous in the last little while.
Now, comparing some fun stats, you mentioned it's a just over an 11-week campaign period down or up there. We've got 14 months to go down here. We're not even having held a vote yet.
Yeah.
You also are spending a lot less. You guys are capped at, I think, $128 million, which includes both party spending and candidate spending for each party. Is my number right on that?
Yeah, it sounds about right. I'm not sure, you know, exactly what those numbers are off the top of my head, but generally,
if you're off
yeah.
by a few million, you're still not getting anywhere close. We had two candidates
no.
for president spend $1 billion last time out. That doesn't include any other federal candidates, governors, anybody like that. And certainly I haven't even gotten into outside groups, but your outside groups are capped pretty markedly,
They are. There was significant campaign finance reform that has happened here over the last decade, and I was even started by the Liberal government before the Conservative government. But Prime Minister Harper has sort of taken that to the next level. You're right. In a federal campaign, corporate donations and union donations are banned. You cannot donate. Only individual citizens can donate. And they are significantly capped as well. It's about $1,100 or $1,200 Canadian that an individual can give a candidate, as well as they can give the same amount to a national party. So, you know, in practice, you can give, maybe $2,500 a year during a lit period, or for that matter, during a year as well. And so those are obviously there's some tax deductions there, but corporations are banned, unions are banned. That is something that Prime Minister Harper brought in. That's one of those issues where, you know, somebody like myself believes in free speech and freedom, but at the same time, he's created a fair and level playing field whereby, you know, having overwhelming unions and third parties and other special interests mucking about in the process. So they are capped in that sense. And then individual candidates, of course, they have limits on what they're able to spend in their riding. You know, each riding has sort of just over 100,000 folks. One of the other interesting dynamics actually in this campaign is the House of Commons had 308 seats at dissolution. And because of the census and the change in population, there's 30 new ridings this election, especially in Alberta, where I am, and British Columbia, where the populations have grown with strong economic growth. New seats out here, some more new seats in Ontario. And then all the boundaries have been redrawn as well. So, you know, not only are the three parties polling strongly and have their respective strengths, there's new ridings, new boundaries, and more seats up for grabs as well. So that changes things a little bit locally and nationally. Makes it one more item a little bit more exciting.
So you've got 30 new ridings. At the same time, you've got I think 31 retiring Conservative MPs. How are they weathering those hits?
Yeah, it's you know there's a lot of folks in all parties who are in fact not running again in terms of the overall number of seats being turned over with retirements in the House. So there were certainly a couple of senior Harper cabinet ministers who've moved on. They've retired, obviously on good terms and simply moving on to the next phase of their lives in the private sector. Those were recent as well, so you can imagine being a cabinet minister for a decade. That's a long time, and so certainly time to do something else for some of those folks. A lot of those folks were MPs as well before the Conservatives formed government, so had been members of Parliament for 15, 20 years. So it's natural, and you know, there's some strong new candidates running. You know, a lot of the first, second-term candidates have raised their profiles, and shown strength of their own. You know, I think that's true, to be fair, of opposition parties as well. You know, the reality is it's Prime Minister Stephen Harper. It's the Westminster system, of course, so it's different than down there. But it's not unlike a presidential campaign as well, in that some voters are voting for issues, some are voting for their local candidates, some for the parties. But, you know, overwhelmingly, it's true here and it's true down there. It's for the individual running for the top job. And so that's certainly why the Conservative campaign is centered around the Prime Minister showing strength on issues like national security and terrorism, and just being, you know, Canada being a stronger, taking a stronger lead globally on economic and security issues, especially in the G7, certainly strengthening our relationship with the U.S. on trade. We'd sure like to see some of those pipelines built, though, I must say, Jim. You know, national security and energy security for the Americas. We think that you know, Canadian crude is makes more sense than foreign crude coming into the U.S. And so, you know, that's another big issue on the campaign as well, natural resources as it plays into the economy and national security and North American relations. And obviously on issues like that, the Prime Minister has shown considerable strength and you know, got the job done on creating jobs and that sort of thing. And so that's really what the narrative, I think, will be over the next few weeks. We'll see how things shake out.
I'll tell you, if you want to get that Keystone XL pipeline built, here's what I would do, because we, you know, it's bogged down here. Just build the pipeline up right to the border and just say, yeah, hey, we're going to turn it on this date. So yeah, you guys either build a pipeline or you just, you know, or figure out something else to do with the oil, and we'll see how it works. That's funny. The last 5 years, that's gone from being an issue that nobody in the U.S. really knew about to just blanketing TV coverage. It's become a talking point, and now in two, it's going to have been a talking point in two presidential campaigns by the time 2016's over.
Well, and the funny thing is, it's a pipeline that's going to go, you know, essentially right through the area where the Bakken field is being developed in Canada and America. It's all happening right on the border there. You know, you're doing 1 million barrels a day now out of North Dakota, and that's happening in Alberta and Saskatchewan as well. And you know, there's pipelines all over the place there, and this would be the safest, best pipeline in the world, as opposed to you know, shipping by rail and bringing in foreign super tankers from the Middle East, right? And it's an interesting argument as well, in that, you know, there's certainly where you are, there's pipelines feeding into every house and every building in the U.S. and in Canada, and people seem to forget that. So
yeah, but Rob, when has there ever been an accident with a train or an oil tanker? Come on now, like that never happens.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's you know, the Prime Minister's in Canada has certainly been a leader on that. The NDP and Liberal leaders, unfortunately, have not been, and that's disconcerting for a whole bunch of reasons. But yeah, it's certainly an issue between Canada and the U.S. now, and hopefully how things shake out here in Canada in the next few weeks, and down there in the next, I don't know, how many years is your campaign still going on there? And we'll get it done. So yeah, it is an interesting issue, and it has been an issue on the campaign and will continue to be. You know, issues like the TPP trade deal and other bilateral deals, relooking at NAFTA, you know, different tariffs and trade barriers that we're trying to remove on both sides, even within NAFTA. You know, this is still a huge issue. It's about energy, it's about security, it's about jobs on both sides of the border. And so it's certainly a common issue in our campaign, and will be, as you say, has been and will be in your campaign as well.
You mentioned trade. Maybe it's not something a lot of Americans are paying attention to, but it's something
some sectors, yeah.
But exactly. It's something that people are concerned about. What are the repercussions that could come out of this election?
Well, there's yeah. I mean, that's a great point. So our campaign, as you mentioned, from the Arts of Gym, began about a month ago, at the beginning of August, and it was announced that the campaign was underway on the weekend that the Trans-Pacific Partnership was, supposed to be put to bed in Hawaii at that long weekend in August, and of course it didn't. A lot of those issues were not really related to Canada and the U.S. Sugar in Australia and different things like that, car parts in Japan. That's a major issue for Canada. There's little issues that Canada and the U.S. need to work out. I think the bigger issues are external to the Americas, and they're not insurmountable. And, I think largely we're on the same page. There's some other issues that remain at the forefront as well, and I think you're right. I think some people are paying attention. For example, the government of Canada has been fighting for some time to remove the country of origin labeling restrictions down there in the U.S., which was started by some beef producers in the U.S. As a special interest. Unfortunately, it's been a fight that's gone on for over a decade now. And the final decision came down at the WTO a couple of months ago. And so we've asked the Senate and the House there to repeal it as per the international trade obligations. One of the things that happened right before the campaign was our Minister of Agriculture sent a statement to Washington saying that there would be retaliatory sanctions immediately if this isn't resolved. So there could very well end up being tariffs coming into Canada on things like California wine and Florida citrus and, all sorts of things like that. But, of course, those are in no one's interest. The beef market is integrated. We need to ensure that. That's only going to mean good news for ranchers from Alberta right down to Texas. And that's true of other agricultural issues as well. And I think it's true on the energy side also. So, there's little grievances here and there, but I think, based on the outcome, and if we have positive outcomes, people realize that we don't want to dig in an environment globally where, who knows what sort of bubbles are going to pop next in China or in the Mediterranean or where have you. We need to work together to keep the borders open and create jobs and grow the economy on both sides of the border. That's key. Our trade relationship is essential, and we have the best friendship and trade relationship I think of any 8 nations anywhere. So we need to just ensure that we take that to the next level.
Well, I'm frankly scared about retaliatory sanctions igniting a U.S.-Canada Cold War a la Canadian bacon. So I'm going to be very hopeful that that doesn't happen.
Exactly. You want our bacon and our beer, which is actual beer up here. I think that's true. And I think that though a lot has happened that's positive.
Well, we'll be paying attention. Some of us will be paying very rapt attention down here to how it all shakes out in the coming weeks. And hey, maybe after it does all shake off, we can have you back on the podcast and tell us what it all means with whatever results come through.
Absolutely. No, I'd be happy to do that again. And it sounds good. I know a lot of folks do pay attention down there and so that's exciting. So stay tuned. I know Kramer from Seinfeld tapes Canadian Parliament. So you'll have him as a listener for sure. And happy to come back and talk about what it all means when the dust settles in October, November.
See, I was very, very careful to only ask you that when I was recording, so I completely put you on the spot. Robin, thank you. Thanks for joining us. It's Robin Spear, one of the better and brightest political and public affairs operatives and minds in Canada. Robin, thanks for joining this crummy little podcast.
Thanks a lot, Jim. Have a great weekend.
Thanks for listening this and every week. You can follow the Crummy Little Podcast online at crummylittlepodcast.com. You can find us on iTunes, subscribe, and leave a review. And you can, of course, follow me on Twitter at Jim Eltringham. Thanks again for listening in.